Okay, good morning. Sorry to be starting a few minutes late. I'm calling to order this meeting of the House Committee on Children and Families, Finance, and Policy. Welcome to all. We're going to start. We're a little bit short of some members who I know are running a little bit late because we had a late night, and so many thanks to members for that. Ms. Conn, let's start with the roll.
Chair Pinto.
Present.
Vice Chair Keeler.
Present.
Lee Daniels.
Present.
Representative Bliss.
Present.
Representative Coulter.
Present.
Representative Davis.
Present.
Representative Hansen. Representative Hemmingson-Yeager.
Present.
Representative Hicks. Representative Hudson.
Present.
Representative Katiza-Watum.
Present.
Representative Lee.
Present.
Representative Nelson.
Present.
Representative Pettis-Vega. Representative Zalesnikar.
Present.
We have a quorum.
Thank you, Madam Clerk. I'm going to move up to the front to present a bill. And Madam Chair, if I can, I'll move House File 2471 to bring that before the committee.
Sounds good, Chair Pinto. Do you want to let us, your bill's moved before the committee. Tell us about your bill.
Thank you. And I'm actually going to move then the DE3 amendment. And just to explain that, I should note the 2471 is a bill that would make changes to the child care assistance program and to make it available to more families. And what the DE3 amendment does is it expands it into, as you'll see on the first page, the Great Star Farm Minnesota Children Act of 2023, intended to address issues of affordability and quality and compensation for people who do this critical work of child care and early learning. And so I'd ask members to support the DE3 so we can then discuss the bill.
Sounds good. All in favor of the DE amendment, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say nay. Amendment is approved. Proceed with your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thanks, members. I'll repeat the thanks for everybody for your attention last night, and I'm going to ask that we bring that same positive loose energy to this morning as we consider this bill. So, members, we've had discussions in our committee about the great need for affordable and high-quality early care and learning at livable wages for the people who do the work. There's nothing more important than getting our young kids off to a great start. We know that brain development in the earliest years makes a huge difference, and we know that it's not just about the early learning side of things, that our families and employers and communities are dependent on available and affordable and high-quality child care. And so when you combine all those things, we know that there's a huge need in our state for this to have this sector work well, and there is a cost to doing that. We've discussed that as well. What the Great Start for All Minnesota Children Act of 2023 does is that it faces into the need and the cost. I want to say right up front that the cost to provide affordable, high-quality early care and learning for families at livable wages for providers, and I'll note that affordability means families are still paying something in, which they don't do, 7% of their income, which they don't do once children start kindergarten, and the people who do the work would not be receiving elementary school teacher wages, but at least receiving non-poverty wages. The cost of that is $6 billion per biennium. So it's a substantial sum. And we know that the benefit of making that investment is well worth it. So what the Great Start for All Minnesota Children Act of 2023 does is that it has a series of investments and a series of provisions to get us towards that affordable, high-quality early care and learning at livable wages. What I'd like to do is to turn to Claire Sanford to walk us through the bill, Madam Chair, and then have some testimony regarding it.
Good morning. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and continue with your testimony.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. My name is Claire Sanford, and I am Government Relations Chair for the statewide Minnesota Child Care Association, and I am very excited to be here as I served on the Great Start for All Minnesota Children Task Force in a non-voting capacity, and it is truly thrilling to be here to present the attempt to turn that incredible work into real action for Minnesota children, families, and early educators. It is exciting to have gotten to this point where we not only have broad agreement on the problems in this space, lack of affordability for parents, lack of access to quality for children, and abysmal compensation for early educators, but now, really for the first time, we have broad agreement on the solutions. So, Madam Chair and members, the solutions are in this rather large DE before you. And for those of us who have been in the early education and care space for a long time, this is a big, hairy deal. I am, like someone said this morning, I feel caffeinated and I haven't had caffeine. I kind of feel the same way. So there are two parts to this amendment, two things that the Great Start Task Force laid out. The first is a long-term vision for how we can really make transformational change in our state. And then the second portion involves short-term efforts in existing programs for immediate action and relief. To the amendment. Article 1 is the title of the proposal, obviously, Great Start for All Minnesota Children Act of 2023, acknowledging both the work of the task force, but also the work of this body going back to 2019 when there was first a proposal with this title. Article 2. A key recommendation of this task force was the establishment of a completely new family benefit system that took the best parts of child care assistance, or CCAP, and early learning scholarships and brought them together. This is what you will see here in the new Great Start Scholarships program. The purpose of Great Start Scholarships is to ensure affordable access to high-quality early care and learning for all children 0 to 5 whose families desire it. This specifies that the Children's Cabinet will lead the development of this program in collaboration with the Commissioners of Education and Human Services. However, I also want to note, if the Department of Children, Youth, and Families proposal heard Tuesday moves forward, the commissioner of that new department would take on this responsibility. We just can't assign responsibility to someone who doesn't exist yet, but that would be the goal. In developing the program, the Children's Cabinet slash commissioner is tasked with integrating the functions, administration, and funding from current CCAP and early learning scholarships, considering all the task force recommendations, and transitioning most children birth to five currently using CCAP and scholarships to the new funding stream, Great Start Scholarships. Also, this is extremely important. A key task will be developing ways to include local community input on both needs and methods of supply building and supply maintenance, a nod to the fact that there is no one-size-fits-all solution to this problem across the state. Each community will require or desire a different mix of options and ways to build them. It will also direct the commissioners to maximize federal resources and flexibilities. Minnesota does not currently do this in many areas in CCAP, which is a federal-state partnership, and sometimes we put up some of our own barriers, which we need to address. Subdivision 3, the requirements of this new benefit system include family-directed scholarships for families voluntarily participating. A core piece of the task force recommendations is family choice, including the choice not to participate if families do not wish to. Family eligibility includes any child not yet in kindergarten, birth to five. Provider eligibility includes programs that are licensed and rated via Parent Aware or Parent Aware rated school-based and Head Start programs. A simple online application process for families. An integrated electronic attendance tracking and payment system to streamline processes for providers and assist program integrity efforts. This is truly needed to move the needle. This is part of Office of Legislative Auditor recommendations. Actually, several of the things in this amendment are OLA recommendations from multiple reports over the last few years that we have but have not yet acted on. Amounts for individual scholarships must ensure that no family pays more than 7% of their income for all children under five. That is the federal recommendation. We have had that at least since the Trump administration as a federal recommendation for families should pay no more than 7% of their income for early care and learning. And we also need to take into account market rates and costs of quality models so that providers are actually paid what it costs to provide these services. This is really the crux of this amendment and the task force recommendations, the 7% standard for families and subsidy amounts for providers that actually relate to the cost of providing quality services. We won't achieve this transformative vision overnight, obviously. The task force deliberately set forth both this North Star transformational vision for the state as well as short-term recommendations to bring immediate relief to families and providers while that larger infrastructure is developed. So we'll turn now to some of these short-term recommendations as we move towards the long-term vision. Article 3 makes several changes to CCAP in line with short-term recommendations by the task force. It amends the definition of family so that guardians, custodians, foster parents can access CCAP for support in raising their children. It includes an annual cost of living adjustment between market rate surveys so that the cost of care and the reimbursement providers get better keeps up with the market over time. It expands family income eligibility. This is a big deal. To the federally allowed maximum of 85% of state median income, a tremendous immediate help for middle class families. This number is about $100,000 a year for a family of four versus our current eligibility, which is more around $50,000 a year for a family of four. This would help so many more families. It simplifies CCAP authorizations. It reforms and reduces copays for families, and it pays rates at the 75th percentile, also the federally recommended level. Article 4 of this amendment makes changes to the Early Learning Scholarship Program in line with short-term recommendations. It aligns income eligibility with the adjusted CCAP program so that both would go up to 85% of state median income. I can't even handle it. Programs working together. We've been waiting for this for quite some time, not all having slightly different income eligibilities. In Section 2, there are new priorities for scholarships that were recommended by the task force, and you have already seen in Rep. Coulter's HF 1277, previously heard. On lines 18.3 to 4, you see that children from low-income families will remain a priority for being served regardless of the eligibility expansion to middle-class families. This is in line with the notion of serving all low-income families first and then moving up the scale. And lines 18.9 to 18.11 reinforce this, directing the commissioner to expand income eligibility as resources allow. So with this language, we believe the proposal is scalable and we could move incrementally up the income ladder if needed. 2 minutes left. I told Chair Pinto, really? How are we going to do this in this amount of time? On lines 18.25 to 29, new direction is given to the commissioner surrounding Pathway 2 scholarships regarding the need to preserve existing capacity in our system while expanding availability specifically for children birth to three, an area where our supply crisis is particularly acute and most expensive for families. Lines 19.1 to 2 clarify that scholarships awarded via Pathway 2 shall be portable and truly parent-directed from a family's perspective, just like Pathway 1 scholarships are currently. In Article 5, there's a whole bunch of infrastructure components and supports. One in Section 1 is the Child Care Retention Grant, or not grant, the Child Care Retention Payment Program. It is coming out of the governor's budget, and it was recommended by the task force. Child care stabilization grants funded with federal COVID relief money were to do exactly that, stabilize, not expand, not improve, not strengthen. Child care retention payments are designed to pick off where those current grants leave off. The payments will reach all providers in good standing and award a monthly payment based on the number of FTEs. And for family child care, this is very important. Providers will be able to count for up to two FTEs worth of payments. It is a 100% compensation support for benefits and pay for our early educators. And there's more accountability than there has been in stabilization grants, which were considered an emergency support. And this follows Great Start Task Force recommendations that in addition to per child funding, providers should receive some base level of operational support. I'll try to go quickly through these pieces. In our next section, there was a task force recommendation to consider aligning Parent Aware, our quality rating system, with licensing such that any licensed program automatically receives 1 star in the quality rating system. This matches what several other states have done to combine their licensing and rating systems. The goal here is to ensure that the floor of the developing early care and learning system includes both care and education preparation for kindergarten. It also directs the commissioner to develop a process that would allow programs to opt out of the automatic one-star rating. So that would still be an option for providers. But they would be ineligible for these retention payments if they did not participate. Section 4 directs commissioners to work together on the development of a wage scale for early care and education professionals. Section 5 has a proposal to develop a cost estimation model so that providers are paid at a rate where they can actually pay people what the wage scale says and provide quality services. Section 6, the dry but oh so exciting part, details steps to be taken to modernize our IT systems for programs impacting young children. This is hugely necessary. We are told year after year, oh, we can't innovate, we can't do this because the IT systems literally can't do it. Enough is enough. And finally, Section 7 establishes a task force on early educator competencies, recognizing that we have many in our current workforce who have very important skills in the care and education of young children, but not necessarily the official educational credentials that go along with those. So we want to develop a system to recognize and honor those as we move the whole workforce forward. Thank you. You are welcome.
Thank you. And Madam Chair, I'll just note for members that there's a Great Start for Every Child one-pager that has a really nice summary of the bill as well.
Perfect. Okay, we will move on to testifiers. First up, we have Bukata Hayes. And if you're on the testifier list, if you could start to move down so that we can roll right through. Good morning. You can start by introducing yourself and the organization you're with. And then just to remind testifiers, we are having a two-minute limit just to stay on track with time. Go ahead.
Sounds good. good morning. I'm Bukata Hayes, Vice President for Racial and Health Equity and Chief Equity Officer at Blue Cross Blue Shield of Minnesota and Chair of the Blue Cross Blue Shield of Minnesota Foundation. I'm pleased to join you today to underscore the importance of the early childhood investments you are considering with House File 2471 and to demonstrate the relationship between early childhood and health outcomes in our state. Blue Cross Blue Shield of Minnesota is the state's largest health plan, proudly serving approximately 2.6 million members. As we navigate a complex and changing health care landscape and face some of the deepest racial and health inequities of anywhere in our country, at Blue Cross we fully recognize that 80% of health is influenced by factors outside the walls of clinics and hospital settings. There are many social drivers of health that have the biggest impacts on people's ability to be healthy, with education being one of the most critical factors. The connection between education and health is well known. 90% of brain development happens before children start kindergarten, and research shows that quality child care and early learning results in children and our children being more likely to enter kindergarten on track. This sets them up for lifelong educational success and better physical health from childhood to the adult years. It is important to call out that access to quality child care and early learning significantly impacts the racial inequities we see in our education system, too. The average cost of child care for an infant is more than $16,000 a year. For a family making the median state income of $71,000, that they would spend more than 20% of their income on child care. We know that many families lack access to quality child care and early learning because of this high cost and many other reasons. This is especially true for families of color and those living in greater Minnesota, communities who are more likely to live in poverty. And we know that these inequities early in life lead to significant health inequities seen later in life. But the good news is that investing in child care and early learning disrupts this cycle. Research from the Minneapolis Federal Reserve Bank found that mothers of young children have been particularly slow to reenter the workforce since the early months of the pandemic due to a shortage of child care and concerns over safety and affordability of child care, which has led to the absence of tens of thousands of workers. This is incredibly challenging on employers who struggle to fill job vacancies, and as a large employer, we recognize the importance of this. Investing in our children is one of the best public investments we can make to support the health of our society. That's why the Blue Cross Foundation has focused on this for over 20 years, and why we continue to advocate for children and families. I thank you for your leadership in addressing this very important early childhood need that we have in our state and for the opportunity to share my testimony with you today.
Thank you, Mr. Hayes. Next up, we have Rama Huddle. And Courtney Greiner would be after that. Good morning.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. Hi, my name is Rama, and I'm with Kids Count On Us. Hi, my name is Rama, and I'm here to testify today in support of the FH-2471, the Great Start of All Minnesota Children Act of 2023, to get every Minnesota child off to a great start. I'm a mother of two young children, a 2.5-year-old and a 1-year-old. I'm able to be here today because my mother's caring for my children. I'm usually the one at home with them. My husband works full-time over the road, so he's usually often gone during the week, sometimes 2 to 4 weeks at a time. So I'm pretty much a single parent. I'm not a stay-at-home mom, however. I work full-time from home while caring for my kids. I took a $4,000 pay cut so I can work remote, so I can be with my children and work at the same time. I'm not doing this because I want to. No one wants to experience both the exhaustion and the guilt of feeling like you're neither a good parent or can do your job to the best of your abilities. It's not easy to concentrate on meetings when you're silently hoping your kids will stay asleep for an extra hour. It's not fun to schedule all my meetings during nap time. Sometimes I wonder what happens when they'll no longer be napping, or what happens when it's spring and summer and they want to go outside when the weather is nice. I can't safely supervise my children and be in meeting. The only reason that I have my children at home while I'm working is because I have little to no other choice. We cannot afford childcare. Together, my husband and I make too much to qualify for child care assistance. Child care in Dakota County is relatively expensive. It would cost us about $2,500 a month to send them. That's $30,000 a year, which is nearly half of my salary. I love my job. I'm a managing director at a nonprofit organization that helps housing stabilization for families. I teach classes to immigrant communities to help close the home ownership gap we have here in Minnesota. It's important work to my community, myself, and I do not want to nor can afford to give it up. I need an income to help provide for my family. The Great Start for All Minnesota Children Care will help cap costs for all child care families in Minnesota at 7% of their income. For my family, that will be $30,000 per year, will drop to $10,000 or less. It would make it possible to send my children to child care where they can learn and grow with their peers, where they can be loved by teachers who can give them the full attention they deserve. I would be able to actually do my work if I had child care, and I'll feel like a mother when they are here. I urge you to pass this legislative and give parents of young children the relief they need to be better employees and better parents. Our children deserve their mothers to actually be their mothers. Thank you.
Thank you. I think our next testifier is parking. So we'll go on to Nicole Fretham, and then we'll come back to Courtney.
Thank you. Thank you. Madam Chair and members, I am Ramsey County Commissioner Nicole Fretham, and though I'm here today as a Ramsey County Commissioner, I've also been a policy expert for the Child Care Assistance Program at DHS, a director and curriculum coordinator at a high-quality child care center. I also currently serve as the policy co-chair for Generation Next MSP, the board chair for the Community Action Partnership of Ramsey and Washington Counties, and as a board member for the Suburban Ramsey Family Collaborative. I have a master's degree in early childhood education, a graduate certificate in public policy, and a law degree. Most importantly, I'm a working mother who has relied on child care centers, family child care, license-exempt certified centers, private in-home care, friends, families, and neighbors to care for my two children for the last 14 years so that I could work and do all the other things I just mentioned. This bill is the transformational change in our early care and learning infrastructure that I have been dreaming for the last 15 years. We, despite a lot of talk and reports, we haven't done much to actualize change. We've celebrated small wins and bites around the edges, and I don't want to diminish them, but with a $17 billion surplus, this is the year to take action. I agree with everything that's been said, and I want to focus on a few pieces that I think we need to be talked about. One, this is an important bill that would expand our workforce in Minnesota by giving parents the option to work full-time without paying their entire paycheck into child care programs. I sent a survey to families in my district to ask them about their child care costs and experience. One family in my district, two parents and three kids with an annual income of $115,000 a year, which is just under 85% of SMI for their family size, reports that one parent in the household only works part-time part of the year because the costs of child care are too much and their entire paycheck would be paying child care. The investments in CCAP and early learning in this bill would immediately help this family. The broader expansion by Great Start scholarships would do the same for many other families who are similarly situated. This bill would drive quality. When families can choose quality and aren't constrained by cost, they do. Another family in my district responded to my survey and reported that they pay over 10% of their annual income in child care expenses. And even at that amount, they were not able to go with their first choice child care provider due to costs. I also want to emphasize the technology investment. Outdated, cumbersome, and inefficient technology is an issue across human and social services programs, and early care and learning is not immune. It's one of the major challenges we face as a county bringing in caseworkers to administer these programs is that we're bringing in people who are asked to operate systems that are older than them. This is the system by which we administer millions of dollars in cash and food assistance, and it's the backbone for the CCAP programs system. It's just a pretty face on top of this. I have copies if you'd like one. I was going to make a shirt. I'm happy to speak more, but I think one of the other important pieces that hasn't been talked about is the way it would remove stigma and expand access for our children with lowest incomes. If we instead recognize that child care is an important educational and economic program that should be administered at the state level and not a public assistance program that's administered at the county, we open it up to all families. When all families are utilizing this program, or the vast majority of families, nearly every provider will participate. That means families with the lowest incomes are able to choose from a greater variety of providers and do so without the stigma they face now of being one of the kids on assistance. Thank you.
Thank you. I was trying to watch the door, but just seeing, did Courtney Greiner?
I'll note something, Madam Chair, if I can.
Yes.
Which is members, and you've kind of heard some allusions to this, the bill consists of, the pieces of the bill come somewhat from the governor's budget. I want to make sure to say this at some point, so I thought I'd say it now. There's some gubernatorial proposals in here. There are proposals regarding CCAP from Representative Hemmingson Yeager, regarding scholarships, Representative Coulter. So this, what's terrific about this bill is that it's taking a number of the best ideas from a number of places. And I so much appreciated what the commissioner had to say, but I want to make sure to note that, that these pieces and we've kind of have heard in different forms in different ways and will be, but it's a broad vision that is pulling them all together. Thanks. And we may be, Madam Chair, as we wait for the testifier, perhaps we want to see if there are member questions.
Well,
either
we
way.
Hope to. Is there any public
good point.
Testifiers? Good morning.
Good morning, Chair and members. I'm Nancy Jost. I'm the Director of Early Childhood at West Central Initiative, which is based out of Fergus Falls, and I've been in the early childhood field for 50 years. I'm also the co-chair of Minnesota's Transforming the Early Childhood Workforce with Ann McCulley. I'm here to quickly talk about two pieces that were added to the Great Start Bill, House File 2471. The first piece is an expansion of the current retain program. In the governor's budget, there is funding for retention payments, which are not connected to education. They are a base pay for caring for children, whereas the retain proposal would allow more providers to qualify for retain grants that are connected to levels of education as an incentive to increase levels of education and to reward people for staying in the field. The second piece of our workforce request is called comparable competencies. We want to make sure that people who don't have a CDA or 2 or 4 year degrees aren't left out of retain. We want them to have a way to demonstrate their knowledge and skills compared to a certificate or a degree. Both of these pieces the retain expansion, and the comparable competencies will be worked into the wage scale that has been developed and was part of the Great Start Task Force. The wage scale, as it is in its present form, will need to be more fully developed. Having these two pieces added to House File 2471, the Great Start Bill, are very important to make sure that we are addressing the child care workforce shortage. Thank you.
Thank you. I think Courtney Greiner has shown up. Are you ready to testify? Okay. Come on down.
Sorry, I'm a little out of breath. You're good. Drove from Duluth, I'm now ready. So
we appreciate you making the effort to be here.
So if I have to take breaths, that's why. Thank you for having me, though. My name is Courtney Greiner, and I'm the director and owner of Minnie Mo's Child Care in Esko, Minnesota, and I'm also a leader with Kids Count on Us. Today I'm here fighting for Sally, a single mom of twins who's a social worker for the state, who wouldn't be able to afford our tuition at Minnie Mo's. She wanted quality care for her children but couldn't afford it. In addition to the tribal care assistance she received, we also gave her an internal scholarship of over $60,000 for her two children over the last 4 years. She wanted her kids to feel safe and happy with their children's care, and we wanted to provide that. I'm also here advocating for Kayla, a six-year employee, a mom of two whose husband is sometimes hours away for work. She can only work at Minnie Mo's because her partner has health insurance and can financially help support their family, and because Minnie Mo's, again, has given over $75,000 in free child care. So she can continue to work, and it makes sense financially. I'm here for Carissa, a four-year employee, who has avoided going to the doctor because she doesn't have health insurance. She has two jobs, and she's still struggling to pay for her groceries and her mortgage. At Minnie Mo's, our full-time teachers make an average of $35,000 a year. They receive no medical or dental insurance and have no retirement plans. These teachers are taking home an average of $24,000 a year. The majority of our teachers are young women starting families, buying homes, and trying to make ends meet. The Great Start for All Minnesota Children Act of 2023 would cap the amount a family pays for child care at 7% of their income. This would provide opportunities for our families to base family planning on their hopes and dreams and not on the cost of child care or available openings. Sorry. If child care is funded and families are paying reasonable costs, we'll be able to provide quality care to more families and create a much more equitable system. Families shouldn't have to lower their standards for care due to the cost of limitations. Due to cost limitations. The Great Start Task Force proposes to do this by establishing a new family benefit system that would merge the strengths of the current CCAP program and scholarship programs into one program, known as Great Start Scholarships, saving time, money, and confusion in the distribution of these funds. The bill proposes to immediately invest to improve teacher compensation through retention payments that are direct to provider payments to be used for increasing their compensation. The teachers will be able to contribute to their family's financial situations positively. We can reduce our turnover and create true career opportunities for our teachers. We can help them prepare for their futures with health and dental insurance, retirement, and other benefits that we're unable to afford now due to the cost of business. We need these teachers. We need providers. By doing this, we're able to support employees back into the workforce. Passing this bill will allow us to take the first step to dramatically and critically invest in our child care. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Greiner. Thank you for making the drive down here to advocate. I know as a Greater Minnesota member, it is an extra step, so yeah, I appreciate you doing that.
And it starts snowing.
Well, be safe. Be safe going home. We'll move to member discussion. Representative Zalesnikar.
Thank you, Chair Keeler, and thank you, Representative Pinto. Child care has been a big thing, and I'm glad to see the presentation today. I just wanted to ask your thoughts on, I think it's page 11, on section
11.9, it talks about the authorization requirements. And so I understand the income, the 7% max for which I understand that formula and the expense that it is. And the goal is to get people back into the workforce. I understand all that and to support children and families. I wondered if you could tell me, it says that the county agency must consider the amount of time the parent reports. There's a report process on an application or a redetermination form for them attending because they're either working, it appears to be 25 hours a week, or they're in school full time. That's my understanding of the program. And I wondered if you could explain to me, and I'm sorry for my ignorance because it's my first year here, but if you could just explain to me the process of how that works. Is there a reporting system back? I'm thinking of my nursing home. If somebody's in the hospital, or if I've had a nursing home resident on medical assistance and they're in the hospital, or I would have to report that they're not in the facility that day. And then that there'd be a function of the report by the state that would then recalculate a formula of what I'm paid as the provider. Is that the same process that happens in childcare? So if for example, somebody's not working 25 hours a week or more, or from they don't, they're not full-time in program, how is that process tracked to just have a check and balance system?
Okay. So the two different questions there. One, once child care is authorized, families have a certain number of absent days per year. Those absent days are reported when providers submit their billing forms. So after a certain number of absent days, the family doesn't, they aren't paid. The provider isn't paid for absent days beyond that point. It's separate from the authorization piece. The authorization piece happens when the family applies or is redetermined. Right now, the process is pretty complex. You need to line up everyone's schedules. If there are two parents, you need to overlap it. There's a calculation for, okay, how much travel time you got, breaks and whatnot. It's a challenging process, and for our county, our county workers are primarily the ones who are doing this. It's one that's very error prone, and often the errors don't result in any sort of difference in payment because of the way payments work. Generally, if someone is attending child care for more than 25 hours a week, they're authorized for more than 25 a week, they're going to get paid a full-time rate most of the time. What this does is simplifies for the vast majority of families. We do have a category of families that are that need to report more specifically any changes to their schedule reporting families. This leaves that intact, but says for the vast majority of families, if you're working or going to school over 25 hours a week, we're just going to authorize full-time care. It's going to make it much simpler for the county workers. And right now here in Ramsey County, you may have heard we have a backlog of over 5,000 public assistance payments because of how challenging it is to get people through this process. So that's going to simplify that. It's unlikely to have a big fiscal impact because whether you're authorized for 35 hours a week or 40 hours a week, it's going to be paid about the same, but it also simplifies for providers because then providers have to remember the individual nuances of how things are authorized. Once a family is authorized, unless they fall in that schedule reporter category, their authorization stays at the same level for a full year, and that's a federal requirement of the program.
Representative Zalesnikar.
Thank you. I just have one further question. So it sounds to me that the child care provider tracks attendance, and I'm familiar with that, having had children in daycare, that they would do that daily. So how is the system of assuring 25 hours a week of employment, what is the double check system with the employer and the employee, not just the child care?
Commissioner?
So that happens at their initial application, at redetermination. The family needs to submit documentation that they are working in general at least 25 hours a week. And then because federally, once that happens, you can't change it for a year. So there is another check at that redetermination point. The only difference would be if someone completely ends their employment, that they have to report that
in the CCAP program. So we don't, there is no way for families, you know, to do that. You'd have to have families report weekly, you know, especially because a lot of the families currently on child care assistance are working hourly wage jobs where they might not know their schedule from week to week. And because federally we couldn't change it, there's no reason to have them report weekly. That would be overburdensome, and I don't even know if it would be allowed. I think it's not allowed to make them report that much since we can't change it. This would just simplify that initial process rather than having to compare multiple schedules once you see someone who's working over 25 hours a week or going to school over 25 hours a week. We just know we're going to schedule them as they're receiving full-time child care to manage that.
Representative Zalewski.
Thank you. You know, my hope would just be that we have some double check system. This is a big amount of money, and we have a huge workforce issue, and I'm thrilled the child care providers are ready to go and able to take care of. I just want to make sure that we have a accountability and system that the employer has the employee at work. With the processes that are in place that allows for absences, that's not my, wouldn't have been my business when I was an employer, but there's no, it doesn't sound to me that there's a way, there's an application process and an annual review, right?
Yeah.
But then it would be possible for somebody to have the child care and fill out an application, if I'm listening right, and it, a year could go by, and they filled out they had a job with X. But there isn't a system to check that until that year goes by that they had their child, that they were at work. The child could have been at child care. That system's got to check. But they may not have been at the job. Am I understanding that right or wrong?
Commissioner?
You are understanding that right, except at that checkpoint, if someone had been unemployed for more than 3 months, they would receive an overpayment because they needed to report that. Yeah. It would be labeled an overpayment. So this piece here doesn't change the existing system where we're not asking families to report every week that they were at their job because we can't federally do that on CCAP. That would be a over-reporting. Now, in terms of for the other piece, that job, there is no way because you'd have to have connection to every single employer of every single person on CCAP and force them to report every week whether the person was there or not. And that's not currently in the program, and this doesn't change that. This simply simplifies the authorization process.
Representative Zalesnikar.
Thank you, Chair. And the reason I ask is employers do that for unemployment. Providers do that in the world of caring for seniors. If there's an out-of-facility day, it's tracked. So it seems to me that a program like this, we're investing. We want to have the outcomes happen, and I'm all for it. I just want to make sure that there's the check and balances because we are in a severe work shortage too. And so the goal of this is to support the families and have that system. And anytime you have a system, there's an opportunity to have loopholes. And I'm not saying that that's going to be prevalent in any way, but I just want to make sure we have thought through checks and balances because we do in other programs of unemployment and various things where we have money flowing in large amounts of money for the greater good of the whole that we're thinking through those. So thank you.
I think Representative Bliss.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question, excuse me, on Section 6, Information Technology, line 26.27. States here, the Commissioner of Information Technology Services shall develop and implement to the extent of funding. It goes on to describe what they need. But then on the very last line, it says the Commissioner may contract for the services contained in this section. I would rather have that. We've seen what happens when Minute tries to develop software. It's not pretty. I would rather see it where it says the Commissioner must develop an RFP and reach outside for solutions. There's technologies out there that are currently available that could do this at a relatively inexpensive cost. I believe we had a proposal before to do a $1 million study to find the stuff. And to be frank, you know, if you just hire a consultant to come in and develop your the scope document for your software, that'd be much less than $1 million. And you could then use the other money to hire somebody. But I'd rather see something in here requiring the commissioner to go out for RFP. We shouldn't be developing software in-house. There's already software out there. It's a huge waste of money. It's a jobs program for the IT department. Trust me, I'm IT. I don't mind working, but as a director, I knew that my guys had strengths, and there were people out there that we could contract with that had the expertise that have already done this. I'd rather see that, you know, that the commissioner must, if practical, RFP the solution.
Chair Pinto?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thanks, Representative Bliss, for the question and drawing on your expertise. So I think just a simple change of that word from may to shall or must, I think the concern I'd have was that it would mean that sort of nothing in that paragraph could be done in-house at all. And I could imagine that, like, part of the implementation you'd want to do in-house. But I could imagine it may make sense to direct an RFP regarding certain aspects of it. So maybe we can do this. Bill's being laid over. Is I'd love to draw on your expertise and talk this through about kind of what is a better way. I'd want to make sure the commissioner has a fair amount of flexibility, and again, that we wouldn't you know, artificially just sort of hand everything off. But there may be something that does make sense. So let's continue to discuss that. And thanks
right.
for it.
Thank you,
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't really have a question regarding this proposal. Maybe one will pop up. I tend to do that, start rambling and then come up with a question. But I just want to kind of express an observation in the discussion and the testimony regarding not just this bill, but a lot of the proposals that we've taken up in this committee and others, frankly. And that is, you know, we commonly hear or see presented the everyday, very relatable experience of having to make tough decisions in order to manage your family and conduct your daily affairs. Something we can all relate to. Every single day we choose to do this instead of that because of the economic reality that we find ourselves in. And I understand and appreciate the desire, as I think we all do, to make life easier on ourselves and on others. It's a noble impulse. What concerns me is that we might overlook the fact that the same economic stresses that put the screws on individuals and families at the macro level also can put the screws on the state as a whole. And we love to talk about the surplus around here. Surplus gets brought up all the time to make this point or that point. But we should look at where that surplus came from and where it's going and what it portends for the future, because at least half, or around about half, by my understanding, is one-time money. It's not money that we're going to have coming year over year over year. On top of that, if you look at the economic forecast for the state, our state's income is going to be relatively flat. I mean, that's the nonpartisan estimate going forward. So, you know, when we think about, like, the concept of a family shouldn't have to spend more than 7% of its income on child care, I think we hear that, and our general sentimental impulse is, yeah, that sounds about right. That sounds good. The point's been made that it's 0% for K through 12, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's a compelling argument. But again, when you broaden that out to the macro level, the money's coming from somewhere. And we have to take into consideration where that somewhere is. And ultimately, it is the personal income of the state of Minnesota, the corporate income of the state of Minnesota. The sales tax, the state of Minnesota, and those are actual numbers and will continue to be actual numbers going forward. And so regardless of the merits of this particular, the particulars of this proposal, which I'm not going to take the time to go through and pick apart, or the merits of any given proposal that's coming through this committee or on the House floor, I would just caution us to think about the future And we are. We're thinking about the future of our children and our state on a social level. But there are economic realities and trajectories that need to be taken into consideration. It's not uncommon at all to hear stories of people winning the lottery and then ending up back to being check to check within a couple of years. And it's because they didn't change the way that they approached their handling of money. It would be a shame if we ended up doing something similar as a state. And so, I will pick apart just one little aspect of this, and that is there seems to be some conflicting funding models. And we've talked about this before, you know, the scholarships, which those of us on this side of the table have generally supported because they empower parents to exercise their value judgments on where they're getting the best value for their dollar. But then that's countered by this child care retention approach, which seems to be modeled after the stabilization grants that we've talked about here in this committee, that are paid based upon the number of employees as opposed to the number of kids that are served, which is a little odd to me, because that's, if we're modeling this to some degree or borrowing ideas from the K-12 system, we don't fund our schools based upon how many people they employ. And so it seems like an odd way to balance values. But anyway, appreciate you hearing me out.
We didn't get a question out of that, right? Okay, Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Reginald Hudson, I think you've a number of those comments, I feel like, do crystallize a sort of difference in philosophy and approach between the political parties to a certain extent. And I think every member of the DFL majority is probably champing at the bit. I think there are many different ways to engage what you had to say. I'll bring, from my perspective, two aspects. One is just to point out that our state is one that historically has had relatively higher taxes and spending, relatively higher taxes and relatively higher spending on social programs. And I'll note that we have had one of the strongest economies in the country for years, and some of the very best health and wellness outcomes around the country for years. I'll note there's really only one other state that I think is close to us, which is Massachusetts, which just has a similar model. To just sort of fundamentally, I think we have a model that just says that investing in people, in fact, makes a huge difference. There is one major flaw for Minnesota, which is that we have massive disparities, that not everybody in our state is sharing in that prosperity, that economic prosperity and that health and wellness prosperity. And in particular, we just have a commitment as a state that every child, regardless of race, background, where they grow up, where their family is, deserves a great start in life. And we have, and actually just as a society, we've decided that we're going to fulfill that commitment starting at age 5. And now we've realized, wait a second, the brain science says that actually it starts a lot earlier than that. I don't hear proposals from the Republican minority, and I'm glad that I don't, to end public spending on care and learning when it comes to age 5, right? We have decided that, in fact, having that investment in kids makes a huge difference for the rest of us. And we don't want to have it be that individual economic circumstances are preventing children from getting an education. We've decided we don't want to do that. To my mind, the logic would say that we should do the same thing in the years when we know that the biggest brain development is actually happening, and that with the youngest kids, it's hardest to separate that from supporting their from the families, because, of course, that's with the youngest kids especially, that's a critical point. So we want to make sure to provide support for parents and for families. And we know that child care does that, and in fact, is early learning as well. So to my mind, you can't separate the two, and that investments in the youngest kids have huge payoffs for all of us. And we have made that commitment as a society. When it comes to just a few years later, we're now recognizing the need to do so earlier. And this is an approach that does that and makes sure that we have a sector that is in place and that is healthy to fulfill that commitment to get all kids off to a great start.
Okay. Okay. Representative Coulter.
Excuse me. Thank you, Madam Chair. I think, you know, Chair Pinto really hit on many of the same points that I was going to make, that, you know, as I and others have said in this committee, we spend comparatively less than a fifth on our youngest Minnesotans, those from birth to five, that we do on our on folks in our K-12 system, when really that's when the most development occurs, that's when it makes the biggest difference. And you know, this proposal does carry a not insignificant price tag, but I think it's very easy for us to focus on the costs of doing things, but we don't, even now, I think we don't talk often enough about the cost of not doing things. And the cost of not moving forward with something like this is a system that I think we have all acknowledged is not working for families in Minnesota, for a lot of families in Minnesota. And, you know, I was thinking about this as I was hearing the testifiers speak, you know, this bill is the Great Start for All Minnesota Children Act, but in many ways, this is the Great Start for All Minnesota Families Act. And I think Representative Pinto again spoke to this, that, you know, by doing this, we are not only fighting for kids, but we're fighting for parents. And I'm going to do my best not to, I get so emotional in this committee. What is up with that? You know, there are a number of us who are parents of young kids on this committee, myself included. And particularly over the last few years, it's just been really, really hard to be a parent of young kids. And I, you know, I've talked about before how my wife and I had to navigate childcare challenges. And we're fortunate that we have in-laws nearby, and so we don't have to worry about the cost. But I don't know how much more we can emphasize just how hard it is for parents and families, for everyone, when childcare is out of reach, whether that's an access issue, whether that's an affordability issue, it makes life that much harder. And this is an economic reality. This is the kind of thing that keeps parents up at night, trying to figure out how they're going to care for the people they love the most in this world. And I think we have, as elected leaders of this state, we have a moral obligation, and I would argue a fiscal obligation, to address this. Because we know it's holding the workforce back. We know that our child care workforce is the workforce behind the workforce. So, there certainly is more discussion to be had about what this looks like in the future, but now is the time to act. Now is the time to make sure that we're getting every Minnesota kid and every Minnesota family off to a great start. Thank you.
Representative Davis.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We do have two totally different philosophies. Since I've got here, I've recognized that there are two main philosophies, and this is just the way I see it. We're growing this huge bureaucracy that keeps growing itself. I mean, yesterday we had an example of this. We're in the process of creating a whole new department, and in this committee, which that department has to do exactly with this committee, we weren't allowed to have discussion on it until 9:55. And Lee Daniels and I had a conversation afterwards. I'm going, Brian, it's hitting me. We're developing a whole new department. It seems like this should take the entire session to figure this out and to work this out and to pan this out, because we're literally taking millions and millions and millions of taxpayer dollars to continue building the bureaucracy. And also another thing I've noticed is this bureaucracy really benefits St. Paul, Minneapolis, this surrounding area. And Chair Keeler, Madam Chair, you've brought that up, and I really appreciate that, the focus that you put on helping greater Minnesota. But there's that philosophy, making bureaucracy bigger and bigger and bigger, increasing hardworking families' taxes versus building economic prosperity, coming up with policies that help our economy, that help small business and big business, because big business, the more we prosper them, the more they can actually pay their workers. And we literally had a testifier yesterday, if I'm remembering correctly, her
it was towards developing this whole new department, and she said, I have to work to pay my taxes. I got to tell you, hearing that statement, my mind was blown. I believe, and that if we focus on the parent and on the family and how to prosper them in our economy, that's what's going to empower our children, having a parent at home with them and having a parent who's able to provide. So, yeah, there are two different philosophies in this room, and we can go back and forth all day about which one's right, but I don't think continuing to build this bureaucracy that is going to just continue to empower itself. The state of Minnesota, I learned yesterday, is the third largest employer in the state. That should not be with government. This is America, and more importantly, this is Minnesota. I would just like us to focus more on how we can actually empower our economy, and therefore, I believe that will help families. Thank you for listening to me.
Chair Pinto?
Thank you. Maybe I'll let Lee Daniels go and then respond to, Representative Petizo-Witun, yeah.
Representative Petizo-Witun.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Chair, for bringing this bill forward. I am thrilled to see the return of the Great Start for All Minnesota Children Act of 2023. I'm even more thrilled to know that all the work over the past 4+ years since we brought the initial proposal forward has paid off. And it is in no small part due to the partnership of the advocates and the immense amount of time and effort and compromise that has gone into this proposal. It's just so exciting to me. And I think, you know, I mean, it's been brought up, I think maybe even in the scholarships discussion, I think Representative Daniels had mentioned that my predecessor, Jennifer Loon, had a big hand in the creation of the scholarships program. It should be of no surprise to anyone that she as a Republican and me as a Democrat now representing the city of Eden Prairie care about these issues, care about early childhood, care about children and families, because the people of Eden Prairie care about these issues. The people of Minnesota care about these issues. This is not a partisan issue. And I really wish that in the discussions today, you know, we were maybe hearing more actual suggestions to improve the bill as opposed to just kind of trying to pick it apart, because the advocacy of this bill outside of the legislature is bipartisan, and the people of Minnesota, you know, if we are able to cap their child care cost at 7%, frankly, it does allow more parents to stay home. I mean, there are two parent households that would love to have a parent home with their kids. They can't financially make that work up until potentially the time when their kids are a little bit older. And I think that, you know, when we cap those costs, it expands the opportunity for those families. I really want to just ground us in the fact that the child care crisis is actually worse in Greater Minnesota. So some of these proposals that we're putting forward, yes, they benefit Minneapolis, St. Paul, they benefit the suburbs, but they are also going to benefit families across the state. And I think, you know, we have, most of us have some sort of connection to Greater Minnesota. I'm a property owner in Otter Tail County. My husband grew up there. I have a niece who recently had a baby. So, I mean, I'm in tune to some of these issues that are going on in Greater Minnesota, even though I represent the suburbs. And I just really want to point out that this is not an either-or situation. This proposal, this Great Start for All Minnesota Children proposal, is the biggest yes-and proposal. And it's incredible because when we think about the economy and we think about supporting the economy, study after study after study shows that the best return on investment that we can make is investing in our littlest learners and our Minnesotans and their families. Some upwards of 8 to 14 times. So when we look at that and we think, okay, this is a lot of money that we're putting in to a program like this. Absolutely. And the money is not going to come right back out immediately, but we're going to save in special education costs. Our businesses are going to see more workers return to the workforce. I mean, these things have been proven. And I just think it's critical that we look at it big picture and not just like, oh my gosh, this is a huge amount of money, but how is it going to impact the state going forward? And I really want to raise that up and thank you for your work over the years on this and the advocates too.
Lee Daniels.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't know where to begin. It's such a big lift, and my colleagues have made excellent points on everything from the IT part of it to the sustainability of the investment of, I believe, around $8 billion, about half of their surplus. And Representative Davis was saying about how I'm still tired from last night. I'm sorry, Madam Chair. My brain is still gone. But made some really good points on the family. And I unfortunately see the end game coming where we'll spend all this money, and in 3 to 4 years from now, we'll be coming back and having to cut all these programs, because now instead of having a safe $17, $18, $19 billion surplus, now we're going to have a $6 or $10 or $12 billion deficit. The ideas, I think, are worthy. I just don't know if we should put that much tax burden on the shoulders of Minnesotans when we are in the top six categories of every single tax there is, and we were in the top five tax categories until it was 2017. I think we dropped one of the income tax. I think it was tier one income tax by 0.25%. And they went from fifth to sixth. In corporate sales tax, our corporate taxes were second in the nation. And I know the argument is always, well, we have a lot of things for that high tax dollars. It's still a good place to live, and the economy is still growing. But the forecast for the next 4 years doesn't say that. The forecast for the next 4 years is, was a 0.9% increase in income taxes. Corporate taxes were flat. And those are some of the biggest income we have. Sales tax seems not to be doing too bad. But then if you look on the flip side of that, you've got more people borrowing money, using their credit cards, going into debt to just pay the bills that they're on now. So my same theme: pump the brakes, think about it, use caution, and just think about where we might be in 4 years. And I would hate to be in the committee that has to start cutting these programs that we've launched. So that's my main concern. My hats off to my colleagues. They made very good, compassionate arguments why we should proceed with caution. And thank you for the discussion. Thank you for the bill, Representative Pinto. I know you and I have worked together quite a bit. I think the ideas are good, but I think there might be a problem with the dollar amount. And, thank you, Madam Chair.
Final words, Chair Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Lee Daniels, you mentioned being able to see the end game here. And I feel like I can see the end game too, right? The end game is that we have early care and learning be affordable for families and be high quality for kids and have decent wages for the people who do the work. And the end game is that at some point there's going to be a kid, some kids, many kids, all kids, who are going to have gotten off to a great start, who are going to be inventing something they would not have invented, who are going to be providing high-quality care to somebody else that they wouldn't have done, who are going to be productive, thriving members of our society because we helped them and their family off to a great start. we know common sense would say that that's how that works. Research says that's how that works. That's why we invest public dollars in education. And there's a disagreement about where those public dollars go. I know from the Republican side, Democratic side, how we spend those dollars. But we all agree that we spend the dollars. So I guess I don't know why we wouldn't follow the research and the common sense that says that that applies in the earliest years as well. Or the other option is that we don't meet the need and families continue to have childcare and early learning be unaffordable, and so therefore they're out of the workforce, and then we have workforce squeezes in various professions, or they have to have their kid be taken care of by the neighbor down the hall who they just met, or the new boyfriend who they just got together with. We can have experience for kids that are not enriching, that are not going to be high quality, and we can have the people who are doing the work continue to live in poverty and then spend public assistance dollars, as we do. One-third of the people who do this work get public assistance through other programs because they get paid so horribly. Remember, the worst wages you can get with a high school diploma are doing the most important work in society of helping to take care of young kids. So that's the choice before us. So I can see the end game as well, that someday a future prosecutor like myself is going to be dealing with somebody who had a really bad start to their life, because that's unfortunately I see that every day, or we make the necessary investment to make sure, as we do in other areas, we follow the logic in other areas, to make sure that kids and families have the support that they need so that they are able to thrive. We know the logic works, and it absolutely works in this place as well. So I would urge us to follow that end game, Lee Daniels and all of us. And I know this bill is being laid over at this point, but I would certainly urge us to do all that we can to make the investments that all these folks following the research is suggesting that we do, and would urge your support as the bill moves forward. Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Thank you, Chair Pinto. House File 2471 will be laid over for possible inclusion. Members, we are going to move to the last bill and not do the vehicle bills right now because we took more time to be able to have conversation around this bill. So, Representative Hansen, if you'd like to head to the front. So we're House File 1521. Okay, up next we have House File 1521. Rep. Hansen moves that House File 1521 be moved before the committee.
Thank you, Chair. Yesterday I presented a bill in economic development for the Department of DEED, and it was done in 2 minutes, and so we're on a race to see who can present an agency bill faster today. And so this one is going to be really quick, I promise. So thank you, members, and good morning. House File 1521 is an agency bill that addresses technical and housekeeping changes needed for statutes governing child welfare, child support, and the federal SNAP program. Provisions related to child welfare aligns effective dates for the North Star Care for Children payment rate assessments with existing practice. It ensures that statutes governing relative searches include all relatives as defined in existing law and corrects an incorrect statutory cross-reference. Changes related to child support provide clarity on when a court can deviate from child support guidelines when a recipient's income increases. And finally, the bill repeals a statute related to the SNAP program that's not in compliance with the federal laws governing SNAP. And with that, I'll turn it over to DHS for more comments.
Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Introduction, agency, go ahead.
Great. Jennifer Sommerfeld with the Department of Human Services, and I will try to go quickly as well. I think Representative Hansen summarized the bill pretty well. I'll just say Section 1 is the piece that aligns Minnesota Assessment of Parenting for Children and Youth. The MAPC aligns how we assess that with the timelines that we use currently. Section 2 is the relative search piece. Right now the language would appear to say that we would could be interpreted to say that we would only look for adult relatives of a child's siblings, not the adult relatives of a child. the Section 3 is the statutory cross-reference. That statute has been ineffective and not in place for, I think, 11 years, something like that. So we're just removing that. Section 4 is the deviation clarification. The way it is right now, it could be construed to mean that you could not, a court could not deviate, or could deviate, I'm sorry, from child support guidelines if child support was going to go down because a recipient's income went up, and that was not what was intended with that statute when it was passed. And then there are the repealers. The SNAP statute is obsolete because federal law is different than our statute, and federal law controls. And the repealer of the child support statute is regarding interest on child support arrears, and that's being repealed because we no longer charge interest on child support.
That was fast. Good job. Is there anyone else here that would like to testify? Seeing none, we'll move to member discussion. Oh, Representative Katiza Watu.
Thank you. And this question, I think, is for Ms. Sommerfeld. I just in the section about the effective date of the new rate. So that's the new, once it is signed, that's after the MAPC has been reissued. Is that?
Yes. It is existing practice, so it's actually not really a change in policy. It's how we already do it. The statute was just a little confusing and unclear. Does that make sense?
Representative Katiza Watu.
Thank you for that clarification.
Yep.
Any other member discussion, questions? Lee Daniels.
I have nothing to add. It's a very clean bill, and it has my support.
Okay. Representative Hansen.
Thank you. I move that House File 1521 be laid over for possible inclusion, and thank you for your time this morning.
Thank you, Representative Hansen. House File 1521 will be laid over for possible inclusion. And I think I just gave you all 10 minutes back of your day. Woo-hoo. So just reminders, the committee will meet next on Tuesday, March 14th. The plan is to meet in the morning as usual, 8:30 to 10. Then we'll recess until later in the evening and we'll reconvene at 6:30 to take up more bills here in SOB room 200. With that, committee's adjourned.